This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
And 571 points. Active stocks include Iris Corp, Lambo Group, and Priceworthy International. Gainers are led by Nestle Malaysia, Pharma Niaga, and Duo Pharma Biotech. Decliners are.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Daily Digest on the Bigger Picture. I'm Sharmila Ganesan, and together with me is Dashran Johan. And today's show, we are dedicating it to one person in particular. His 2006 talk, "Do Schools Kill Creativity?" has been viewed online over 60 million. times and has been seen by an estimated 380 million people in 160 countries. Sir Ken Robinson, regarded as one of the world's leading thinkers on reforming the education system, sadly passed away last Friday. So we pay tribute to his legacy and look back at his powerful takedown of the world's current education paradigm.
Mm. And if you'd like to chime in on our conversation, you can tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. So, Sir Ken Robinson, hailed as the world's most well-known education luminary, passed away last Friday at the age of 70 after a short battle with cancer. The outpouring of grief over Sir Ken's passing is testament to the profound impact he had on so many lives. As we mentioned earlier, his TED Talk entitled "Do Schools Kill Creativity?" is the most watched of all time with more than 66 million views. Many have also written about his influence on the thinking of educators around the world, saying that it is unparalleled in history. Mm. His legacy of critique about schools is likely to have a lasting and profound impact for decades to come.
Yeah, so in a tribute to Sir Ken, Oliver Friedman, who's an editorial producer at TED, wrote in the TED blog of how Sir Ken was critical of contemporary educational systems, which he believed educated students to become good workers rather than creative thinkers. Mm. So what Sir Ken advocated for instead was a personal approach, one that treats kids as unique individuals with a diversity of talents. I'm quoting here, "We have to move to a model that is based more on principles of agriculture," he said in a follow-up to his 2006 talk. And he went on to say, "We have to recognize that human flourishing is not a mechanical process, it's an organic process. And you cannot predict the outcome of human development. All you can do, like a farmer, is create the conditions under which they will begin to flourish."
Hmm. And in another tribute to Sir Ken, Brandon Bastide wrote in Forbes about how Sir Ken's energy and enthusiasm for the topic of education was unrivaled. So too was his wit. Mm. As Brandon put it, anyone who watched his TED Talk or saw him speak knew instantly they were in the company of a genius. In the original ideas he conjured, the searing critiques he articulated, and the incredible humor he wove into it all. And a New York Times bestselling author, the Liverpool-born Ken Robinson, led national and international projects on creative and cultural education across the world, unlocking and igniting the creative energy of people and organizations. He was named as one of Time, Fortune, and CNN's principal voices, acclaimed by Fast Company magazine as one of the world's elite thinkers on creativity and innovation, and ranked in the Thinkers 50 list of the world's top business thinkers. In 2003, he received a knighthood from Queen Elizabeth II for his services to the arts.
Mm. So his legacy is really a clear and powerful takedown of the world's current educational paradigm. You know, he argued that schools focus most of their time on things like rote memorization and simply of knowledge mastery. Mm. He provided compelling evidence that not only do schools do a poor job of promoting creativity, they actually kill it, you know, through a system designed to produce students in factory-style outputs. Mm. So according to Brandon Bastide of Forbes again, while most of the world's educators and employers rush to agree that they want students to be critical thinkers, Sir Ken was the one who helped us all think more critically about thinking. Is it just critical thinking we're after? What about creative original thinking? So suddenly the conversation got more nuanced. You know, Brandon argued that it was these nuances that Sir Ken introduced that allowed us all to think with greater clarity about what we really want for kids and for schools.
Right. And if you aren't one of the estimated 380 million people who have seen or heard his groundbreaking TED Talk, we thought we'd play some snippets from it for you so you can hear and understand better his clarion call on creativity in education. So in this first clip from his 2006 talk, Sir Ken shares why he thinks creativity is as important in education as literacy is.
And my contention is all kids have tremendous talents and we squander them pretty ruthlessly. So I want to talk about education and I want to talk about creativity. My contention is that creativity now is as important in education as literacy, and we should treat it with the same status. I had a great story recently, I love telling it, of a little girl who was in a drawing lesson. She was six and she was at the back drawing, and the teacher said, this little girl hardly ever paid attention. And in this drawing lesson, she did. And the teacher was fascinated. She went over to her and she said, what are you drawing? And the girl said, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the teacher said, but nobody knows what God looks like. And the girl said, they will in a minute. What these things have in common, you see, is that kids will take a chance. You know, if they don't know, they'll have a go. Am I right? They're not frightened of being wrong. Now, I don't mean to say that being wrong is the same thing as being creative. What we do know is, if you're not prepared to be wrong, you'll never come up with anything original. If you're not prepared to be wrong. And by the time they get to be adults, most kids have lost that capacity. They have become frightened of being wrong. And we run our companies this, by the way. We stigmatize mistakes. And we're now running national education systems where mistakes are the worst thing you can make. And the result is that we are educating people out of their creative capacities. Picasso once said this. He said that all children are born artists. The problem is to remain an artist as we grow up. I believe this passionately, that we don't grow into creativity, we grow out of it. Or rather, we get educated out of it. So why is this?
Why is this indeed? So in this next clip, Sir Ken thinks the answer lies in the fact that every education system on Earth has the same hierarchy of subjects.
Something strikes you when you move to America and when you travel around the world. Every education system on Earth has the same hierarchy of subjects. Everyone, doesn't matter where you go. You think it would be otherwise, but it isn't. At the top are mathematics and languages. Then the humanities and the bottom are the arts, everywhere on Earth. And in pretty much every system too, there's a hierarchy within the arts. Art and music are normally given a higher status in schools than drama and dance. There isn't an education system on the planet that teaches dance every day to children the way we teach them mathematics. Why? Why not? I think this is rather important. I think maths is very important, but so is dance. Children dance all the time, if they're allowed to. We all do. We all have bodies, don't we? You know, did I miss a meeting? I mean, I think... Truthfully, what happens is, as children grow up, we start to educate them progressively from the waist up. And then we focus on their heads, and slightly to one side. If you were to visit education as an alien and say, what's it for, public education, I think you'd have to conclude, if you look at the output, you know, who really succeeds by this? Who does everything they should? Who gets all the brownie points? You know, who are the winners? I think you'd have to conclude the whole purpose of public education throughout the world is to produce university professors. Isn't it? They're the people who come out the top. And I used to be one. So there. You know. But, and I like university professors, but, you know, we shouldn't hold them up as the high watermark of all human achievement. They're just a form of life. You know, another form of life. But they're rather curious, and I say this out of affection for them. There's something curious about professors. In my experience, not all of them, but typically, they live in their heads. They live up there and slightly to one side. They're disembodied, you know, in a kind of literal way. You know, they look upon their body as a form of transport for their heads. You know, it's... Don't they? It's a way of getting their head to meetings. If you want real evidence of out-of-body experiences, by the way, get yourself along to a residential conference for senior academics and pop into the discotheque on the final night. And there you will see it. Grown men and women writhing uncontrollably off the beat. Wait until it ends so they can go home and write a paper about it.
He's really funny, isn't he?
Oh, I love listening to him.
Yeah. And that point he made that basically the whole purpose of public education throughout the world is to produce university professors. What do you think of that?
So I think I'd like... he made it really well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's this real disconnect between the purpose of education. As, you know, in many ways, it's viewed as something that either belongs in an ivory tower or it... What's the point? Does it bring you money? Does it bring you success? Otherwise, there's no point. Mm. And I think that's something that even if you went through the education system here, you are kind of, you have that drilled into you, right? Oh, you want to be an artist, but can make money here.
Yeah.
You know? And his point about dance, that's right. You know, why isn't something like dance emphasized as much as something like math? Why do we downplay the importance of something that, again, all of us can do and actually find a lot of joy in doing?
Yeah, and I also like the point about how he say he travels the world and everywhere there's this sort of rigid structure when it comes to the subjects. You know, everywhere around the world, people are pretty much doing the same thing. And it's because... I think on top of, you know, everyone being university professors, training them to be university professors, I think it sort of assumes that everyone, you know, to calculate sort of people's intellect, everyone needs to fit within this box and then you grade them within...
There's one scale.
One scale, right? And something, you know, just this thing brought a memory or just something, it got me thinking about something. So, you know how when we are growing up, you know, our parents always tell you, you know, don't spend so much time in front of the TV, don't watch too many movies, go and do your ad maths and do your maths and do science and all these kinds of things. And, you know, even myself also, I used to love reading Harry Potter, for example, and I used to read that a lot, but... And my parents encouraged reading, but they would always be like, okay, time to put the book down and go and, you know, study, you know, study maths and all of those things. And funny, because years later, when you look at what is actually making me money now, it's the things that were, you know, told that, you know, that that parents told me not to do. Not because it's their fault, it's because that's how the system is, right?
Oh, no, I completely understand. So when I finished SPM, my highest grades were in, weirdly enough, English, physics and maths. Mm-hmm. And so many of my teachers tried to convince me that I should be taking on something like engineering. Mm. Not that there's anything wrong with it if that's what you want to do. But instead of, well, why would you study something like, you know, journalism at that point? You know, it's not going to make you as much money, you'll be more successful as an engineer. So it's this kind of thinking, right? Yeah. And really, in this next snippet that we're going to play from Sir Ken, he takes on what generally people, you know, what's generally understood about the concept of academic ability, which I think feeds into what we've been talking about. So let's listen to that clip.
Our education system is predicated on the idea of academic ability, and there's a reason. The whole system was invented around the world. There were no public systems of education really before the 19th century. They all came into being to meet the needs of industrialism. So the hierarchy is rooted on two ideas. Number one, that the most useful subjects for work are at the top. So you were probably steered benignly away from things at school when you were a kid, things you liked, on the ground you would never get a job doing that. Is that right? Don't do music, you're not going to be a musician. Don't do art, you won't be an artist. Benign advice. Now, profoundly mistaken. The whole world is engulfed in a revolution. And the second is academic ability, which has really come to dominate our view of intelligence because the universities designed the system in their image. If you think of it, the whole system of public education around the world is a protracted process of university entrance. And the consequence is that many highly talented, brilliant, creative people think they're not, because the thing they were good at school wasn't valued or was actually stigmatized. And I think we can't afford to go on that way. In the next 30 years, according to UNESCO, more people worldwide will be graduating through education than since the beginning of history. More people. And it's the combination of all the things we've talked about, technology and its transformational effect on work, and demography and the huge explosion in population. Suddenly, degrees aren't worth anything. Isn't that true? When I was a student, if you had a degree, you had a job. If you didn't have a job, it's because you didn't want one. And I didn't want one, frankly, so... but now, kids with degrees are often heading home to carry on playing video games because you need an MA, where the previous job required a BA, and now you need a PhD for the other. It's a process of academic inflation, and it indicates the whole structure of education is shifting beneath our feet. We need to radically rethink our view of intelligence.
So yes, how can we radically rethink our view on intelligence? Is this in this following clip, Sir Ken discusses the concept of intelligence and how it can be redefined. He also shares a beautiful example of how catering to a child's specific needs and talents brought about a star.
We know three things about intelligence. One, it's diverse. We think about the world in all the ways that we experience it. We think visually, we think in sound, we think kinesthetically, we think in abstract terms, we think in movement. Secondly, intelligence is dynamic. If you look at the interactions of a human brain, as we heard yesterday from a number of presentations, intelligence is wonderfully interactive. The brain isn't divided into compartments. In fact, creativity, which I define as the process of having original ideas that have value, more often than not comes about through the interaction of different disciplinary ways of seeing things. And the third thing about intelligence is it's distinct. I'm doing a new book at the moment called Epiphany, which is based on a series of interviews with people about how they discovered their talent. I'm fascinated by how people got to be there. It's really prompted by a conversation I had with a wonderful woman who most people have never heard of. She's called Gillian Lynn. Have you heard of her? Some have. She's a choreographer, and everybody knows her work. She did Cats and Phantom of the Opera. She's wonderful. I used to be on the board of the Royal Ballet in England, as you can see. And anyway, Gillian and I had lunch one day. I said, how'd you get to be a dancer? And she said it was interesting. When she was at school, she was really hopeless. And the school in the 30s wrote to her parents, said, we think Gillian has a learning disorder. She couldn't concentrate. She was fidgeting. I think now they'd say she had ADHD. Wouldn't you? But this was the 1930s, and ADHD hadn't been invented, you know, at this point. So it wasn't an available condition. You know, people weren't aware they could have that. Anyway, she went to see this specialist. So this oak-paneled room, and she was there with her mother, and she was led and sat on this chair at the end, and she sat on her hands for 20 minutes while this man talked to her mother about all the problems Gillian was having at school. And at the end of it, because she was disturbing people, her homework was always late and so on, little kid of eight, in the end, the doctor went and sat next to Gillian and said, Gillian, I've listened to all these things that your mother's told me. I need to speak to her privately. So she said, he said, wait here, we'll be back. We won't be very long. And they went and left her. But as they went out the room, he turned on the radio that was sitting on his desk. And when they got out the room, he said to her mother, just stand and watch her. And the minute they left the room, she said she was on her feet, moving to the music. And they watched for a few minutes, and he turned to her mother, and he said, you know, Mrs. Lynn, Gillian isn't sick. She's a dancer. Take her to a dance school. I said, what happened? Said she did. I can't tell you, said, how wonderful it was. We walked in this room and it was full of people like me. People who couldn't sit still. People who had to move to think. Who had to move to think. They did ballet, they did tap, they did jazz, they did modern, they did contemporary. She was eventually auditioned for the Royal Ballet School. She became a soloist. She had a wonderful career at the Royal Ballet. She eventually graduated from the Royal Ballet School, found her own company, the Gillian Lynn Dance Company. Met Andrew Lloyd Webber. She's been responsible for some of the most successful musical theatre productions in history. She's given pleasure to millions, and she's a multimillionaire. Somebody else might have put her on medication and told her to calm down.
Told her to calm down. We've seen that with so many students who don't conform, haven't we? You know, many, including Sir Ken, have argued that our education system has mined our minds in the way that we strip mine the earth for a particular commodity, right? And that it won't serve us at all in the long term. We have to rethink the fundamental principles on which we are educating our children.
Yeah. So how would he have done it had he been in charge? In an interview with the New York Times, Sir Ken said that for him, the purpose of education is to enable all students to understand the world around them and the talents within them so that they can become fulfilled individuals and active, compassionate citizens. Mm. So he also said that he would encourage all schools to adopt a broad and balanced curriculum, including languages, math, the arts, sciences, humanities, and physical education, and develop develop non-statutory guidelines and resources to support them.
He also suggested rolling back the current testing requirements in favour of a more informative approach to assessment. So he would support the comprehensive development of early years education and institute a soup to nuts review of the selection, training and supporting and support of teachers. He would also introduce incentives for creative partnerships between schools, families, cultural organisations and the private sector. So in these and other ways, education can and must change for all of our sakes.
Yeah, and we got a WhatsApp from someone who agrees with what Sir Ken has said. He said, our children certainly were suppressed of their creativity and natural abilities. And yeah, I think that's it's an apt way to sum it up, right?
Yeah, I think this idea of natural abilities, right? We, as Sir Ken's, as the snippet we played from him, again, you know, we've come to value certain kinds of things. Even when we look at our current, the MCO period, the pandemic, there are these two really opposing arguments that keep coming up. On the one hand, we find most people more than ever are turning to, you know, to things like books and music and songs and movies for comfort and to find meaning for company. But at the same time, we have countries like Australia increasing the costs of arts education, for instance. We have surveys in Singapore that say people who work in the arts are non-essential, are somehow less important than those who do STEM education. So in these ways, we value certain skills, certain abilities in a way that really de-emphasizes what this others can bring to the table and what they can do for us as a society.
Yeah, that's, you bring up a very good point, because that's always something that is kind of peculiar, but nobody actually really thinks about it, right? Because everybody loves movies, everybody loves going to the cinemas, they love playing games, they love doing all these things. But when their children or, you know, someone in their family says, oh, I want to be an actor, or I want to be a dancer, or I want to be a journalist, or, you know, things like that, towards more of the arts and languages side of things, people are always discouraging, because people are, you know, they say, oh, these jobs don't make money, you can't do this, you won't have a future. But there's a clear contradiction, because you like doing these things. Where's a filmmaker going to come from? Is he going to drop from the sky? You know, you have to cultivate, you know, children and all from a young age, tap into their creativity. You'll never know.
And as a society, we need to give them that value, because the truth is, if we refuse to honor the work they do, if we refuse to remunerate them fairly, if we don't create systems that encourage people who are inclined in that way, then they will not be viewed as important as our engineers and our lawyers and so on. I think anyone that you know, needs to be nudged a little bit in this direction can do much, much worse than to look up Sir Ken Robinson's talks.
Yeah, definitely. You know, though he will be greatly missed, I think his thoughts and ideas will live on. We do recommend you watch any of his TED Talks or download the podcast of his interview with our very own Evening Edition team from 2017. Just search for the podcast title, The Education Revolution, at bfm.my or on the BFM app.
Yep, so that's it, our little tribute to Sir Ken Robinson. You can continue to share your thoughts with us. If you enjoyed his TED Talks, are you inspired to look them up now that you've heard a little bit of them? You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or drop us a message on Facebook. We are BFM The Bigger Picture. And if you've missed any part of today's show, you can download the podcasts on bfm.my/dailydigest, on the BFM app or on Spotify. Coming up at 3 p.m. on Earth Matters, Juliet Jacobs will be speaking to Nick Jasmine Hugh and Sean Yap from the Persatuan Alam Dan Warisan Bukit Fraser, and they will be talking about the proposed construction of a 15-story building resort and spa on Fraser's Hill, which residents are calling for a review of. So stay tuned for that after the 3 p.m. news. But first, we leave you with I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing by the New Seekers on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.